1970. We were not immediately arrested. There was a conversation going on with the administration. Faculty quite often supported us and were involved. But everything is so deeply militarized right now that the arrests come quicker, the misuse of authority and overreaction and violence comes quicker on behalf of the police at times. So that is a difference. It's really scaled up now. Another thing is that the actions of the students and the faculty are nonviolent. And the nonviolent movement in the United States, which took its cue from, it really came out of the civil rights movement and Dr. Martin Luther King and the others heading up that. And the response of in the state of California, of course, in the latter part of the anti-Vietnam War movement, we had Ronald Reagan as governor, and he sent in the National Guard to back up the Berkeley police. So there was occupying campuses by police in later years, but not in the beginning years. But we share, I think, nonviolence, and we share an opposition to indiscriminate use of violence, and the U.S. government standing on making its choices that I think derive from our national history of the occupation of European nations as colonizers all over the world, and then subjecting the native population to genocide. And I see that replayed because we really haven't stood up against that as a nation and atoned for that, nor with slavery, and devised a new way to govern ourselves. And so it gets replayed right now as we are the most powerful nation in the world, as what you see in Ukraine, what you see in Gaza is, proxy states that we depend on to support our corporate interests. And it's a replay of all that trauma of violence that we have endured as a nation and that we subject other people to as part of our foreign policy.
Tatanka Kitbricka, I want to thank you very much.
Okay, my pleasure.
Pledge online at kpfk.org. Support KPFK today. Radio for the future.
You're listening to Fiercely Independent KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and on the web at kpfk.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Negwa Ibrahim. Israel bombed yet another UN school in Gaza on Friday, just a day after Israeli forces massacred dozens of Palestinians in a UN school turned shelter, an attack that has been widely condemned as a likely war crime. Palestinian officials have reported that 3 Palestinians were killed and 15 were injured on Friday's attack. This is the second time that Israel has struck a UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, school over the course of 48 hours. On Thursday, Israeli forces deployed U.S.-made bombs in an attack that killed at least 40 Palestinians, including 14 children, in Nusayrat refugee camp. UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, commissioner said, quote, "Attacking, targeting, or using UN buildings for military purposes are a blatant disregard of international humanitarian law." UNRWA shares the coordinates of all its facilities, including this school, with the Israeli army and other parties to the conflict. Targeting UN premises or using them for military purposes cannot become the new norm, end quote. Eyewitnesses say the attack on the Nusayrat school was horrific, with Israeli forces releasing 2 bombs on the building that was sheltering 6,000 Palestinians who had been displaced multiple times over the course of Israel's genocide. Israeli human rights groups B'Tselem said that the attack is a, quote, suspected war crime, end quote. With U.S.-made bombs being deployed in the attack, this represents direct evidence that U.S. military assistance is being used by Israeli forces to commit war crimes. U.S. weapons have been used in many war crimes committed by Israeli forces in recent months, previous reports have found. Now, these assessments run contrary to a recent report released by the State Department concluding that it's, quote, reasonable to assess that U.S. weapons have been used in violation of international law, but that there is not enough direct evidence of Israel's culpability in slaughtering civilians en masse, end quote. If that report had directly concluded that U.S. weapons are being used to commit Israeli war crimes, it would have spurred the U.S. to consider withholding military aid to Israel in accordance with U.S. and international law. The conclusions of this report by the State Department raised an uproar. A U.S. State Department official who quit after the release of the report said that its conclusions were fabricated by higher-ups in the department to provide cover for U.S. officials working to send Israel yet more aid to be used to commit atrocities against Palestinians. According to the official death toll, Israel's genocidal assault has killed at least 36,600 Palestinians. But the true death toll is likely far higher, as thousands more Palestinians are missing and presumed to be dead under the rubble of buildings bombed by Israel. The count also doesn't include those who have died for reasons like starvation or illness outside of health facilities in the region. Additionally, tens of thousands of Palestinians who are in dire need of medical evacuation or care that is no longer available in Gaza are trapped in the Strip, aid groups are reporting, with Gaza's last pedestrian border crossing having been closed for a month and Israel blocking cancer and other patients from leaving the region. Since May 7th, Israel has been blocking all medical evacuations from Gaza while also escalating its famine, bombing, and forced displacement campaign, creating scores of complex medical cases that can't be treated due to Israel's destruction of the healthcare system in Gaza. Formerly, a small number of patients in critical condition had been allowed to leave Gaza to obtain care in Egypt or elsewhere through the southern Rafah crossing. But Israel took over and closed the Rafah crossing, both to humanitarian aid entering and to patients and aid workers exiting in May. This included a group of 20 medical professionals from the United States who were in Gaza as medical volunteers and were denied the ability to leave amid the total military siege by Israel of the Rafah crossing. 17 out of the 20 medical professionals from the United States who were in Gaza were finally able to return home on May 17th. And with us today to talk about the situation in Gaza and Israel's decimation of the healthcare system in Gaza is our guest, Dr. Mohammed Abdel Fattah, a Palestinian-American critical care physician who currently works at Martin Luther King Jr. Hospital in Los Angeles and who was one of the 17 medical professionals from the United States who recently returned from a medical mission in Gaza and who was there when the Israeli invasion of Rafah began, delaying his departure home. Welcome to Middle East in Focus, Dr. Abdel Fattah.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Can you first discuss why you made the decision to join this medical mission to Gaza with the Palestinian American Medical Association and the World Health Organization? And what did you all as medical volunteers hope to accomplish while there?
Yeah, you know, I personally, my family, a lot of my friends have been witnessing this genocide for the past 8 months now. You know, every single day I was waking up, checking my phone, looking for the latest updates and just seeing horrific images of men, women, children just being bombed in their homes, horrific injuries. And this continued, you know, since October 7th, every single day. And so I became increasingly frustrated knowing that, you know, our taxpayer dollars were funding these weapons and this war in general. And so I looked at sort of whatever opportunities I could find to help out directly and indirectly. And I came across multiple organizations online and put my name down as a volunteer because I do have some medical skills. I was hoping I could offer some assistance directly there in Gaza. And, you know, we were hoping to provide relief to the healthcare staff who have been so overwhelmed the past 8 months, now working every single day trying to save these patients. So my main goal was to try to provide relief to the local physicians there and provide direct assistance to the patients on the ground.
And as you mentioned, you know, all of us are watching in real time this genocide happen, and we're watching it, you know, here in the United States through, you know, various types of media. That said, when you arrived in Gaza, what did you see and experience that you both anticipated based on what we're all witnessing in real time? And what did you also see and experience that you did not anticipate?
I mean, so what's being broadcast to us every single day is just a portion of what I saw. It's much more horrific, catastrophic. The amount of destruction that's in Gaza is unbelievable. You know, we didn't get a chance. So when we entered at night. So, and it was complete darkness. So I didn't get a chance to see the surrounding destruction. But on the day that we were evacuated they took us through a route, a deconflicted route that was coordinated with the Israelis. And the route was a long route. And so we went through Khan Yunis, we went through Rafah, and every single building that I saw severely damaged or destroyed. There were bullet holes in every single mosque that I saw. Every minaret was destroyed. Everything was gone. And that was shocking to me. It was flat. It was just pure destruction in every building. So just the amount of devastation and rubble that I saw, you know, it drove me crazy because it had me thinking, like, once there is a ceasefire, once this war is over, how are these people going to rebuild their lives? It's going to take so much work and so much cooperation amongst global nations to assist them, because it's just catastrophic what's happening there. You know, the healthcare facility, we were at European Gaza Hospital in Khan Yunis, which just borders of Rafah. The hospital itself is a refugee camp. It's sheltering 30,000 people, families with children. And so that was very evident as soon as we got there. You know, you step foot on the hospital and there's kids everywhere, hundreds, thousands of kids coming up to you, giving you hugs, trying to learn our names. And you could tell they're all so thin. So you could tell they're severely malnourished. Their clothes have holes in them. They haven't bathed in days. And they're there, you know, seeking refuge. They've been evacuated from their homes throughout Gaza multiple times, 4 or 5 times already. And so I guess what I did not anticipate, to answer your question, is just the amount of children and how they're affected by this war. I mean, this war, I am convinced now, it is a war on children. You know, just the kids that I'm mentioning outside of the hospital, they've been out of school for 8 months. They have no routine in their lives. They are wandering the hospital all day, all night. I saw them 1, 2 a.m. Kids were playing still. There's no routine. They've been out of school. They're suffering from malnutrition. So this is going to have lasting effects for generations. And this is just outside the hospital. I haven't even talked about what's inside the hospital.
So I want to get into that more in terms of inside the hospital and you know, building off of what you are talking about, which is the complete destruction of the infrastructure and all infrastructure within Gaza, that including the healthcare system. Can you elaborate and talk in more detail about how the healthcare system has been completely destroyed by Israel in Gaza, and what resources, if any, do doctors in Palestine, including those like yourself coming from abroad to try to help and do volunteer work, what do you have in terms of being able to even provide medical treatment?
Yeah, I mean, the healthcare system devastation and destruction has been systematic. It's been calculated. Every clinic has been destroyed. Most of the hospitals are completely non-functioning. There's only a few left. Some have been completely destroyed, as we saw with Shifa Hospital. Nasser Hospital at one point was completely destroyed, and they just reopened it. They are preventing humanitarian aid. You know, just as we were entering Rafah from Egypt, there were miles of huge trucks standing there waiting to enter Gaza. Huge trucks with medical supplies, with food, waiting for weeks to enter Gaza. They're being prohibited from entering by the Egyptian authorities and the Israelis. And so this was very frustrating for us because we, each of us, there was a total of 19 of us. We brought about 8 to 10 suitcases filled with medical supplies, with baby formula, feminine hygiene products, coloring books, sandals. And we packed those suitcases as much as we can. You know, we're limited by the airline weight capacity. And so for me to see those trucks just standing there with much more aid than we were bringing in and not being allowed was so frustrating. And so, you know, the capacity itself, the hospital is very limited and everything is limited from medications to supplies to staff. A lot of the physicians themselves have been killed. You know, Israel has killed over 400 healthcare workers since the start of the war. And so there's limited staff, there's limited resources. There's no hand soap in our ICU. We have no way of washing our hands and there's no sanitizer. And so infection has been spreading like wildfire in the ICU. And so everything is limited. And, you know, luckily we were able to sort of practice and do our best because we brought in the supplies that we had. We brought in over 250 pieces of luggage. So, you know, eventually that ran out as we were entering our second and third week, that ran out.
So what were, you know, in your time there, what did you experience directly as the most needed and urgent medical needs of those in Gaza?
Yeah, I mean, they have needs for everything. I'm telling you, like, I was overwhelmed with the amount of children that I was seeing. Most of our ICU was children. I don't treat children as an adult ICU doctor here in Los Angeles. The majority of the ICU was children, and them, you know, they had severe wounds, explosive injuries, shrapnel all over their bodies, limb amputations, burns where you can't even recognize their faces. These burns were weeping because they were not being changed every day, and so there is a need for everything. You know, most of these patients have such severe wounds that they need to be evacuated to Egypt for their treatment. And, you know, our hospital in Gaza was not able to manage the complexity of these wounds, despite all of our efforts, despite the best effort of the local staff and the expertise of the specialists that we had. It just was not enough to manage these complex cases.
This is Middle East in Focus, and we are talking about the situation in Gaza and Israel's decimation of the healthcare system in Gaza with our guest, Dr. Mohammed Abdel Fattah, a Palestinian-American critical care physician who currently works at Martin Luther King Jr. Hospital in Los Angeles, and who is one of the 17 medical professionals from the United States who recently returned from a medical mission in Gaza and was there when the Israeli invasion of Rafah began, delaying his departure home. So, Dr. Abdel Fattah, can you tell us, what are some things about the situation in Gaza that is not being told, both within mainstream media and alternative media, that you witnessed firsthand?
You know, just the extent of this war, it is affecting every single human being in Gaza, from the old to the young. Every single one of them has a story. Whether it's losing their homes, whether it's losing multiple family members in their families, whether it's being unable to complete their studies, severe malnutrition in the kids, you know, and just the amount of devastation that this has caused on this 2.2 million people, it's going to have lasting effects. And I wish that our country can see how much of their lives we have destroyed. We've already destroyed so their futures, their development in these young kids. I mean, with this amount of malnutrition, they're not going to develop correctly. They're all, you know, have psychological trauma that's going to affect their functioning moving forward. And so, just I wish we could see that amount of devastation. Sure, we see broadcasted, you know, horrific images, but it's all of Gaza. Not one area has been spared. There is not one safe area for them. They have all been evacuated multiple times by the Israelis, been told to leave this area, seek shelter in this safe zone, and then subsequently that safe zone will be targeted. And I saw that while I was there. You know, there was a family in Rafah who evacuated their home to El Mawasi, which is on the beach, on an area on the shore, where they set up a tent. The Israelis told them to go there. And their young boy, about 11 years old, it was a very hot day, so he went swimming with his friends because it's right on the beach. And they came under Israeli fire, gunfire. And so this young boy, you know, they were all swimming and they started panicking. And this young boy went to the bottom of the ocean and he drowned. And this was supposedly a safe zone. And so many people in Gaza told me they are just, they don't know where to go. They can't provide safety for their children. And so it's just devastating. Every aspect of this war has been devastating. Every aspect of their lives is difficult. They can't find clean water. They can't find consistent food. They're sharing one bathroom with hundreds of people. So they have to wait hours to use the restroom. It's difficult to charge their phones. So everything that we take for granted in this country, everything, all the blessings that we have in this country, it was clear to me. Now it gave me so much perspective, and I wish just that every American can understand how severe this war is.
Can you talk about, you know, and this is, you know, again, related to what I believe is related to what you witnessed firsthand, and then, you know, really making sure to come with your firsthand experience and share what you saw that's not being fully shown and demonstrated within all forms of media. So this is sort of related to that. Can you talk about the challenges you and the other medical volunteers experienced when you were trying to leave Gaza right before the Israeli invasion of Rafah? What happened? Why were you being denied the ability to leave? And have there been any attempts since you've now finally returned home to silence you and to silence you sharing your experience and what you witnessed firsthand?
So we entered through Egypt, through Rafah, crossing onto the Palestinian side in Gaza. While we were there, the Rafah invasion started, and the Israeli authorities took over the Rafah crossing. So that delayed our exit. We were supposed to leave on, I believe, the 13th, and we got delayed about 5 days because there was no safe route to exit, and they were determining sort of which crossing that we were going to be allowed to exit through. I'll tell you, while we were at the hospital, there was a UN aid convoy who traveled to our hospital, or they were traveling to our hospital to see if they would be able to send additional personnel to the hospital. And that UN aid convoy was attacked. A tank shell hit one of the clearly marked UN trucks, and an Indian national was killed. And the passenger, Jordanian national, was brought to our hospital. And so we treated her in the ER. And luckily, she didn't have any life-threatening injuries. But for us, that made it real. You know, everyone in Gaza is a target, foreign national or not. And so that, you know, this is despite international law protecting healthcare institutions, healthcare workers. And so that was very clear for us while we were there. You know, eventually we were evacuated by the U.S. embassy. They facilitated our evacuation with coordination with the Israelis. And they, as I mentioned earlier, they took us through a very complex route through Gaza when we were exiting. And right when we were about to exit Gaza, there was an Israeli tank that aggressively stopped right in front of our convoy and would not let us leave. And it stood there with its barrel facing us for an hour. Additionally, there was an Apache helicopter that was hovering over us. And so this was all very intimidating. I was so shocked. You know, as an American, our closest ally, the Israelis, are threatening American citizens. Yeah, that just the whole experience was frustrating as an American taxpayer, knowing my dollars are going there every single day. The second part of your question, have there been attempts to silence me? To be honest with you, no. I've been able to speak freely. Luckily, my message has been received well, and I have not had any negative outcomes or any sort of harassment.
Gosh, we only have a few minutes left, but I have to ask this: why do you think you all were being denied the ability to leave initially?
You know, for me, that was hard to understand because I know that, you know, any harm to a foreign national, you know, it doesn't get good press for them. So I was really not understanding why they didn't want to evacuate us sooner. But it may have to do with sort of the complexity of the operations and the requiring coordination with multiple agencies. While we were there the extra days, we did feel like we were useful to the local physicians. You know, even the local hospital staff, they were asking us every single day, are you guys leaving? Are you going to stay with us? Because they were concerned that once these 30 plus foreign doctors are out, that, you know, there's a chance that Israelis would attack this hospital like they've done other hospitals. They sort of saw us as a shield, that these foreign nationals were a shield in protecting them. So it was really hard to answer that question. I felt guilty, honestly, answering that question. And that is where we're all concerned now. Now that we're all out, we're all concerned about the well-being of the hospital staff, the well-being of the hospital itself, knowing the history of this war, how every hospital has been destroyed. Healthcare staff have been executed. One of my colleagues in the ICU, he told me, one of my closest friends who's a physician, a colleague of mine, was executed in front of me. And so there's always a risk and concern. And I'm always, I want to continue to push the message that we all, as American taxpayers, are responsible for this war. So there's responsibility on all of us to end this war.
So to that point, and this is my last question, and we only have a minute for you to answer. In addition to the billions of dollars of weapons and other financial support the United States is providing to Israel, can you talk about the ways you witness firsthand the United States' role in this genocide in Gaza? And what can we, as those living here in the U.S., do to put a stop to it and to more effectively stand in solidarity with Palestinians in the fight for justice and human rights?
Yeah, the role is evident every single day. As I saw lifeless kids coming in every few hours being killed in front of me, coming in with severe injuries, you know, the role of America is obvious, that every day this every hour that this genocide continues, it's because of our administration. Biden can end this with one phone call, and he refuses. Instead, he sends more weapons. Instead, he provides international cover to any criticism of Israeli war crimes. And so what can we do is keep talking about Gaza. They all told me, keep telling our stories. They were so inspired. They said the one thing that's giving us hope right now are the protests in America. So please keep coming to the protests, talk to your officials, your representatives, and demand that they end this war, demand that they stop sending American weapons to Israel.
This is Middle East in Focus, and we have been talking about the situation in Gaza and Israel's decimation of the healthcare system in Gaza with our guest, Dr. Mohammed Abdel Fattah, a Palestinian-American critical care physician who currently works at Martin Luther King Jr. Hospital in Los Angeles, and who was one of the 17 medical professionals from the United States who recently returned from a medical mission in Gaza and was there when the Israeli invasion of Rafah began, delaying his departure home. Thank you so much, Dr. Abdel Fattah, for being on the show and for your incredible work.
Thank you for having me.
Again, you've been listening to Middle East in Focus. We thank you so much, all the listeners, for joining us today. I want to thank our fantastic engineer, Gary Baca. Please remember, you, all the listeners, are the power of independent radio. We thank you and hope you will keep listening and continue to support us. Our theme song is The Overture from Summer Night's Dream by Marcel Khalife. For KPFK Los Angeles, I'm Negwa Ibrahim, wishing you all light, love, and peace. Thanks for joining us, and have a great rest of your Sunday.